success looks so easy from the outside, but all successful people have had to overcome enormous obstacles along the way, and in many cases, look failure right in the eye. Most successful people don't focus on the struggle, and they rarely talk about it because that's not what creates success. Join us here, where we'll chat with serial entrepreneurs, both men and women, and share the good, the bad, and the ugly of entrepreneurship. We'll talk about the obstacles we faced and how to overcome them to reach the success that you desire. I am your host, Cami Lehman, and this is She's Invincible. Hey everyone, thank you so much for joining us today on She's Invincible. And we have an invincible one to introduce you to today. Kevin O'Connor enjoys chronicling the stories of families and friends through tracing genealogical histories, writing, and picture collections. His prior writing includes personal letters, articles in professional publications, dissertations, anthologies, and presentations delivered at conferences, seminars, and webinars. He brings people together personally and professionally, collaborating with friends and relatives. He plans family and class reunions. In his final educational position, he authored content and provided training in areas including support for substitute teachers, LGBTQ advocacy, and sexual health and family life. He resides in Fort Lauderdale with his husband, Leon. Their family includes 5 sons and 7 granddaughters. Oh my gosh. Kevin O'Connor, welcome to She's Invincible. I'm so excited to have you with us. And today it's He's Invincible. So welcome. Welcome, Invincible One. I'm so excited to finally have you here. What a journey we've had of getting together and getting you on the show. Oh my gosh, let's jump in. Let's tell our listeners, how in the world did you get where you are today? And what makes you invincible?
Wow, what enthusiasm. I love it. I love it. And we're blessed to be able to put this together. We've been trying for a while, and I feel so fortunate to be part of you and part of your show and part of the invincibility. And instead of she's invincible, he's invincible.
And that's right.
And part of what I think my life story represents some of that invincibility. I mean, how many people do you know that were brought home from the hospital and placed in a crib in an apartment above a funeral home? There's where my invincibility started. I think I had no choice in that, of course. But I was raised in a family that owned a funeral home, and we lived in a Victorian house. I was born in 1950. So I've got almost coming upon my diamond birthday next year. But to be in that environment from birth on, and the other thing on top of all this, when I was put in that crib, that bassinet, and for the next 5 or 6 years, that bed or bassinet was next to a performance stage. So and that's because the apartment that my parents created came from the third floor of a Victorian house, which had been a ballroom in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And so when they came into this space in 1940, they had to create a living space, an apartment in a ballroom. And in the time they had, they created a bedroom for my older brother and later me, but they left the stage in the room. And so when I was born, I grew up right next to the stage. My brothers and I, my cousins, we played on the stage. We played underneath the stage and we performed on the stage. So that is what probably inbred in me a love of theater and wanting to be performing. I'm going to a theater class tonight. So from birth to 75 years later, I still find myself dressing up in costumes and singing and trying to keep my feet moving, dancing. So that's one of the things that has made me somewhat invincible. And the other thing is this navigating through that life. And I explain all that. And working in my book, Two Floors Above Grief, it was about the stories I had in the funeral home, about the stories of what it was like to be a kid in the funeral home. and the kind of responsibilities I had and how my parents treated me and created this role of being an ambassador for the funeral home. But they did it hand in hand with my aunt and uncle who lived on the second floor of the house with their three daughters. So here it was, a Victorian house built in the 1880s, first floor funeral home, two floors above grief, with lots of family stories. So the book is less about the clients of the funeral home and more about how our family worked in the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s, 60s, 70s. My family sold the funeral home in 1984. The book, the other part of the book, not the other part, the book is based on 700 pages of family letters that were written over the years, mostly in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, a little bit in the 70s. But I got to be the keeper of those letters. So one of the ways I got to you today was putting those letters together about what do I do with boxes and files and shoeboxes of letters? So I figured out a way to organize them. And when I got them organized and put them in four-inch notebooks, I had a collection of stories from the people that are in the book. And when I went to write the book based on these letters, I would transpose those words in their letters right into the word processor. And I almost felt like a magic in my fingers, or that their words were coming right through to me into the keyboard. It wasn't things I was making up. Certainly, I wrote a lot of other narrative in the book. But when I typed those words in, those people were speaking from where they were when they wrote those letters. We don't have that anymore.
No, we don't.
When I speak to student groups and I speak to other people about the concept of letters and addressing an envelope, friend of mine brought it up the other day. They don't teach kids that anymore in school. I remember being a very big part of my own elementary high school program was where to put the address on the envelope, how to do the return address, where do you put the stamp? And that was just ingrained in us over and over and over. Now, that's a skill that's lost. Yes, we've traded it in for email and the immediacy of that. But one of the things I talk about in the book is how stories at that time came through letters, came through the people that were there. And oftentimes I would receive a letter from two or three people in my mailbox on the same day, and they were writing about the same stories, but from their own perspective. So I marvel at that I got these different viewpoints of an incident that might have been occurring at home, but it was from three different perspectives. So that's a little bit about what Two Floors Above the Grief is about. I chose not to be a funeral director. That's a story in itself. But I followed a passion for education and went right out of college to start teaching in the Bay Area and taught elementary grades, eventually became a principal. I spent almost 50 years working with elementary students, being a principal for 21 of those years at two schools, just loving my job, loving my career, and then spending the last 8 to 10 years of my life in the public school system here in Broward County, Florida, in Fort Lauderdale. And that's where I got the opportunity to work with people in areas of equity and diversity. So working with LGBTQ students, teachers, families, helping them to navigate based on what I learned, which we didn't even get into yet. So during all those growing up years, I had this inkling, for lack of a better word, that I too was gay. In the 1950s, we didn't know what to call it. I didn't know what to call it. I just said, hey, I've got an attraction for men. What am I going to do with this? And what did I do? I buried it. And I find that a lot of my contemporaries have done things similar. I had a great college life. I got to go a year abroad into Rome, developed friendships. I dated a lot. In the mid 70s, I married my college friend and sweetheart and married her. That marriage lasted about 5-6 years. And it would have been an opportunity then for me to maybe come out then. No, what did I do? I got married again because at the time, in the late 70s, 80s. For me, wanting to be a father, the only way I saw possible was to keep developing dating relationships and finding a person who I love to, and we created a family of two boys with. But in my journey, my navigation, after about 20 years, and part of the reason I really finally decided to come out was my then 18-year-old son. He'll be 40 next month. But my then 18-year-old son was exhibiting and starting to talk about that he was gay. And I was sharing this conversation with my wife, his mom. And as I was doing this, I thought, what's that thing about authenticity? How could I be working with my son to get him involved in this if I haven't been authentic myself? So that's what really propelled my own coming out at age 55, almost 20 years ago. And that brought me into a whole nother realm of relationships and partnerships and meeting my husband, Leon. We've been together 19 years, taking me to a point in my career where I never dreamed I'd be working. I spent the last years of most of my principalship with elementary kids, being in elementary classrooms and reading stories and engaging with teachers about math development and reading development and talking to kids, 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds. When I took the job in Broward County, I was given a position where I was on the sexual health team. Part of my job was to teach high school kids how to put on a condom. So in a quick transition, from reading it in 2007, I was reading stories to kindergartners. By 2012, 2013, I learned how to teach kids to put on a condom. How the boys could do it, or how their partner, whether it be their male partner or female partner, could help them in the process. So that was an eye opener to me, but it was needed, because we knew that the sexual activity rates of our kids were pretty high, and leading to quite a few incidences of STDs and HIV. So we wanted to teach kids what they could do to be healthy in their own lives. But when I look at my 50-year career in education, and when I think how I started, as a kindergarten teacher in 1974. And then ending up my career into 2020, talking about sexual health and talking to parents and kids and making videos about how parents can talk to their kids about body parts. And that's a word that never entered my terminology as a elementary principal. It's been a great journey. And then being able to write this book and get involved with folks like you and being involved in podcasts. This has been tremendous. And I think part of that story, and part of what I said, I think there's some invincibility in there.
I think just a little, Kevin, just a little. Oh, my gosh. There's so much here. I'm like writing and writing and writing as you're talking, because there's so many things here. Wow. What a journey. As you say, from reading stories to kindergartners to teaching high school kids how to wear condoms and be safe. That is unbelievable. And everything in between. So let's go back and we're going to break this down a little bit. My first thing that I want to kind of talk about is, why did you choose not to stick with the family business and go out and pursue a degree in education?
Super question, a likely question that people ask. And part of what I explain in the book a little bit is that my dad and my mom and my uncle, my dad's brother, and his wife, who were the adult players in my life then, they had worked very hard to establish this business and to help it grow starting in 1930. When it came to myself, my brother that's 10 years older than me and a brother that's a year younger than me, and I have 3 cousins that also lived in that environment, but they were about 15 to 20 years older than me. But for none of us pursued it. And I can speak to my older female cousins. It just wasn't, that profession wasn't something that a female was pursuing at the time. It's really changed now. A lot of funeral directors and people in the death care industry are female. But for me and my brothers, my dad never really said, or my uncle never did either, you've got to do this. You've got this opportunity. Hey, we built this business up. You have to take it over. That message was never conveyed intentionally or unintentionally. So they wanted to give us the ideas and the freedom to go to college and to pursue what we wanted to do. Or we didn't know. I didn't know what I wanted to do when I went to college. I was a poli sci major, so I thought I'd be a senator or the president or something. But so that was my major, but it had nothing to do with being an undertaker. Well, it had something to do, because undertaking and funeral directing is a service profession. And as I got into college, the doors kept opening and leading me to different aspects of education through undergrad courses I was taking and people I knew that were getting involved in education and people in the family that were happy with it. And it just became something that I wanted to pursue. I liked working with kids. I liked the atmosphere. I love the smell of chalk and the look of a chalkboard and the smell of the old wooden floors in the elementary school. That was part of the appeal. And so I decided to pursue that. And at the time, once I graduated from Loyola in Chicago with my undergrad degree, I moved to Berkeley and Oakland, because there in California at the time, you had to have what they call a credential. There were no undergraduate degrees in education in California at the time. I'm not sure how it is now, but everybody in California had an undergraduate degree in something different than education. So to be put in that kind of a program, well, not put, I had to apply, but to get into that kind of program and start my educational career was just so uplifting and so energizing. And I stuck with it for almost 50 years. So, wow. So back to the funeral home, and there were so many elements that of my work and my ambassadorship in the funeral home as a kid and as a teenager that lent itself to so many of the things that I did as a teacher and a principal. So I learned so many skills as a kid. Didn't know I was learning life skills at the time, but learned so many things from my dad, my uncle, my mom, my aunt. And this being a part of that business really equipped me to work in a community as an educator. So that's
amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's an amazing story, because you hear so many times, like, these funeral homes are family run, mm-hmm. and usually they continue because somebody in the family steps up. I don't know if that's out of, like, they feel like obligated, because what you said, that your uncle and your dad had worked so hard to build that business, you know, that maybe some people do that out of obligation or just think like that's what's expected. But that's cool that you didn't do that and that you were able to pursue what your passion was. And clearly that was your passion. If you spent 50 years in every different aspect of education and the system itself. Mm-hmm. So I think that is just amazing. So, okay. So we're going to go back to the gay thing, just because you talked about it. And so now I feel like I would be letting our listeners down if I don't ask you a few questions about this.
Oh, yeah.
We are here to support all the people and our entire community. And when we talk about a topic like this, I feel like this pertains to every person, every mom, every grandmom, every sister, aunt, cousin. And I think that the more we know, the better we can be and the better we can do. And I do think we all need to do better. So my question to you, you mentioned briefly that you knew when you were young. At what age did you, can you say, like, you really knew, and then what started, like, just burying it?
Okay. Well, I wrote a piece in an anthology. Those are words to say together. An anthology. But that person, the anthology was stories of men that were, it's called Journey Out. And there's just stories of men who made a decision to come out of their marriages. And that part of what I tell in that story is I probably first knew this was happening in me. I didn't know what the this was at the time. But when I was in my early teens, probably late preteens, and this realizing that when I would be with my peers or they'd be talking about different things that really didn't interest me. I mean, they interest me to a degree, but I always had this inkling that I was attracted to other boys or men, and certainly didn't know what to do with that. And just my solution at the time was to bury it. And I did the term in the closet is that part of where that come from. I always felt it in the pit of my stomach. And that whatever phase of my life I was in before I came out was I had this pit in my stomach. And sometimes the pit was very expressive. Sometimes it was so buried, I could kid myself and tell myself it wasn't even there. I got so involved and pleasantly involved in my career, being a dad and doing all the things I loved to do as a dad and still do. But in the midst of all that and living in a community with other dads and other moms, and I used to say to myself, I'll deal with that later, that being gay. And I mean, there was a time when I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area from 1972 to 78, that was the time of Harvey Milk and the Anita Bryant, you know, here in Florida, and the things that were happening, trying to get state referendums passed against teachers who were gay. So I lived in that atmosphere in San Francisco. I would go to the neighborhoods where Harvey Milk walked and lived. And shortly after I moved back to the Midwest from California was when he and George Moscone were murdered. So I always had other events in my life that were happening, and nothing ever really provided in for me an entree to say, I really got to deal with this. But it was thankful for my son for helping me in his own inadvertent way for me to say, I got to come to deal with this. So I think, and when I listen to other people's stories, every coming out story, there's no prescription. There is no story that is ever the same, because the players in everybody's life, not only the players, but the locations and the timing and the history are all so different. And I think that's actually, for me, what gives a real beauty and a real spirit of invincibility to the LGBT world. So.
Yeah. So how old were you and how old was your son when this event happened?
These events were unfolding in the 90s. He was 24, late 90s, early 2000s. So that's about the time. Yeah, he was 18 in 2002. I started to see it when he was 16 or 17. And so when I started to have those discussions, and we as a group, as a family group, and as individuals, my wife, myself, we were all going to different things of counseling, trying to help our family be better, work better, each of us as parents trying to do the best job we could. And so I had a counselor, both group counselor and an individual counselor, who allowed me and made it comfortable for me to put the gay card on the table and to say, I think I just said to her, okay, this is one thing I want to talk about. I've avoided this in other counseling in my life. I've put it away. I would step into it and then run back into the closet. It was her that helped in probably around 2000, 2001, that we spent a lot of our time just going through that and helping me to let go of some of my fears and to cope with those fears and to start the process to journey out, as I made reference to in that book I was one of the contributors to. So yeah. It's a tremendous journey. It's a tremendous, I'm pausing because as I think about the journey, there's sadness and there's joy and there's grief and there's disruption, disconnects, yeah. But there's also connects. And it's just been a part of my life. It's now part of who I am. I didn't allow it to be part of me until that time when I was about 53, 54, 55. And finally, that pit in my stomach was eating me up so much that I finally said, I gotta see what happens next. I gotta do this. And it was scary every time I told somebody or brought it out in the open. It was scary to do it, but it gave me one more step along the way to say, hey, that person accepted me. The next time I talk to somebody, it's going to be a little easier. And that's what's happened through these last 19, 20 years of my life. Now I don't even make it a big, it's people, yeah. When I come into a group, it says, hey, Kevin's here. I don't have to come out. I don't have to say, this is who I was, who I am, who I'm going to be. It's just, I come into a situation. I was just talking to this about another gentleman yesterday on a podcast. When I come into a group or a setting, whether it be a job or a social situation or a family situation, this is who I am. And I don't go in to say, hey, I'm gay, Kevin O'Connor. I just say, hi, how are you? I'm Kevin. And then let them unpack me, and I'll unpack it with them. And it's just, that's the way it is now.
Yeah. You know, and as you say that, to my mind, I think, well, why would you? Like, I don't come into a room and be like, I'm married, Tammy Lehman, right? Or I'm divorced, or I'm widowed, or like, you know, that's not our identity. No. Right. I mean, it has nothing to do with who we really are. It would describe more about what we do in a lifestyle versus who we are. And that isn't something we always bring to a table. Although in saying that, we also shouldn't be ashamed or worried about what other people think if it does come up, right? Like, no more so than we would judge somebody who was divorced or widowed or whatever the situation. So let me say this, like, and I want to kind of clarify here. So your son came to you and had a conversation with you about the fact that he was feeling like he was gay. Did you ever feel comfortable doing that with your parents?
Oh, great question. One clarification is my son didn't come to me. I went to the son. And I opened up the conversation because having not come out myself, but knowing the things I'd been feeling for that many years, I went to him thinking, let's try to get this on the table because I didn't, not that I wanted him to avoid what I went through, but on the other hand, if there's a voice or an advocate that can help him, I wanted to be there. So I brought up the topic to him. And it opened up some discussion, which has evolved over the years. Back to the other part of your question. Did I discuss this with my parents? Yeah, I talk a little bit about this in the book. And there was a time that I was going in one of my counseling times. The counselor said to me, you seem to be having some conflict with the feelings about your dad and all that kind of stuff. You might want to talk to him. And I unpacked that with the counselor a little bit. And then I arranged a time to meet with my dad. I was 29 and he agreed to meet me for lunch. And I wanted to just talk to him about my perceptions of him at the time and how I was wanted to make sure we had a good relationship, but there was something, and I really, for the life of me, I can't even remember what that angst was at the time. But during that conversation at the restaurant, I felt comfortable in letting him know that 10 years prior, when I was a freshman in college, I had had an intimate encounter and a relationship with a friend in college at the time. And I was able to tell him that when I came home that summer, I was just after my freshman year, so summer of 69, that I didn't know what to do with any of that. And that I just came home petrified, knowing that I had this, at the time, what I considered a special relationship, but I couldn't share it with anybody. I couldn't talk about it. And so he said, oh, I'm really glad, even though it's 10 years later, I'm so glad you're talking to me about this. I wish maybe you'd, too bad you couldn't have talked about it sooner, but I'm glad you talked about it now. And then he started to talk about some experiences he had with people he knew in his life. And at that time, he started talking about, which some people consider, there's like a continuum of sexuality. And I don't know what terms we used at the time. I don't think even when I was 29, year was that, 1979, I don't even sure if the word sexual orientation was being used that much then. But sure. He portrayed it in such a way that, you know, there's people that like in the spectrum, maybe 1 to 10. And we all have feeling, his way to deal with it. We have feelings along the spectrum, and some of us can make choices along the way about how we deal with that. So that was the discussion I had with my dad at that time. I was in the midst of my first marriage and was divorced shortly after. What did I do within the next 2 or 3 years? I got married again. My dad and I never brought that discussion up again. He died 3 or 4 years later.
I was going to ask you, did that ever come up again or no?
No.
And you both had that secret and that was it. You just kept going. It.
And he never, he didn't come to me and say when I was starting to, approaching a second marriage, he didn't come and say to me, well, what are you going to do now, Kev? No, he didn't. He just let my life go on. And that would, I wasn't looking for a rescue or anything at the time. I was happy pursuing this relationship. Anyway, he didn't. And if I bring that fast forward to about 2005, when I now married the second time, been married almost over 20 years, come to the point with my son, decided I was going to come out, and I sat down with my mom and told her that my wife and I had decided to separate and get divorced. And then she said, let me get a beer. And so she went to the refrigerator, got a beer and sat down. Okay, we got that. That's a big decision. I said, well, mom, I got one other thing to tell you. What's that? Do I need another beer? I said, well, you might want to get one.
So a shot of tequila or something, right?
So then I told her that I was gay. And we were watching the Cubs game at the time. And she said, look at that guy. He just hit a home run. And so then she finally said, let's go out to get something to eat. What I talk about in the book a little bit, that gap of from 1979 to 2005, I look back and I think, did my dad ever talk to my mom about the conversation he and I had had? I don't know. Mm-hmm. The other thing, when I first told my mom about it and said I was gay and I was trying to figure out how to come out, she said, hey, does this have anything to do with that kid you hung around with in elementary school? A mother's perception. And that particular friend, I think I'd been talking to her about it because he and I had reacquainted ourselves after many, many years. And he came out when he was 19. So maybe I was telling her about that and she made that connection. But thinking, well, gee, was she watching this all along? Was she following this all my life to think, is he? Isn't he? What is he? Who is he? But after that discussion with my mom, we didn't really talk about it again. About that, she welcomed Leon into her life. He was a big part of her life, the last 4 or 5 years of her life. So these transitions, these changes, discussions, who do you bring it up to? Who do you talk to? I try to find the joy and the grief and the humor and the revelation in each one of those discussions. And I'm not only making transitions myself, I was putting people in a position to make their own transitions. And some people accepted it and worked it out. Other people would engage me in conversation. Fortunately, I can't really think of anybody, except for one, which comes to mind just now. I can't think of anybody who knows now or says they won't engage in a conversation with me or they won't talk to me. And that's out of a lot of family and people. So I hope me being forthright and forthcoming in this story might help others to process their own journey in coming out, but also to provide maybe an avenue or use the word permission. But I don't think that's the right word.
Courage, maybe courage,
maybe
right?
Courage.
Or be inspired.
Or let's go back to your word, inspired, or back to a sense of invincibility to say, hey, Kevin has a story about how he came out and he waited till 55. I can do this.
That's why we're telling this story, Kevin, because we are here to support everyone, whether it's male or female or whatever. Okay. So a couple more things around this and then we're going to go on. But your wife. Okay. So this had to be devastating, obviously. Mm-hmm. But did she know, like when you finally came forward, did she ever say like, I had a feeling or I knew or anything like that? Or was she just totally like blindsided by this?
Let me take a pause here. I was married twice. So my first marriage, yeah, she and I had been very good friends in college and just had a strong friendship and then decided to get married. When 3 to 4 years into the marriage, when I started to peek out a little bit and crack that door open a little bit, and I was able to say to her, you know, I have something to tell you. And she said, what? I said, well, I think I'm attracted to men and I'm not sure what to do with it. I was then about 26, 27, 28. And so I picture us driving in the car someplace in the Bay Area. And she says, well, I'm glad you told me. Let's figure out what we can do about this. Let's work on this together. So she helped navigate me towards a counselor that through connections that we had. And then that was the first time in my life I was able to sit with a counselor and talk about it. And then about 2 years later, for reasons probably having to do with me struggling with this identity, but also with other things in our marriage, we decided to divorce. So that's how it happened with the first wife. I don't know the first wife. That sounds so. She's an important person in my life, mm-hmm. And I don't want to just say the first wife. She means much more to me than that. We're wonderful friends. I got a second go around. And when it came and working with my son and talking to him and going to counseling, and then my wife deciding that the time that she would join me in counseling just to talk about this topic, that was a little harder. And I think at one point she asked me, are you gay? And that wasn't in the counseling session. It was at home. I can't remember if we were in counseling at the time or if it came before or after, but I remember specifically she's asking me. And when she asked me, I said to myself, I can't lie about this anymore. But I think rather than saying, yeah, I'm gay, I came out with a statement that said, yeah, I can picture myself in a relationship with a man. Whoa. She left the house for 6 to 8 hours that time. And so from there, we just tried to piece things together, resumed our counseling, tried to figure out next steps, and then finally deciding that staying married wasn't in either one of our best interests. So I think, as I was saying earlier, each time a person comes out, I can only speak from my own experience, but in talking to others, there's so many levels of content and emotion and situation and invincibility to the whole thing. And I guess one sadness part I feel is in my coming out and waiting to come out, I injured two people that were very special and still are special in my life. I guess I'm not sure if you call them casualties, but I've read similar things when men or women talk about their coming out experiences from a marriage and what happens to the partner. If you scroll through Amazon or book sites or websites, there's a lot of literature and memoirs out there about the part that the partner played in the whole coming out process, and each has its own denouement, their stories and how it plays out. But certainly, I think going back to your question, which I forgot what the question was, but I guess the idea of being, how do you present this to your significant other? What happened with me? And that's what happened with both of them.
So. Right. So my question was like, did she know, like, did she already know? And did mm-hmm. she have a feeling, you know, that she just never brought up, or was she totally shocked? So, and that kind of answered that. So what would you say now? Okay. Now that you've gone this way, this twice, you've been through this process. What would you say to other people who haven't come out? What would you say? Like, what is your wisdom to them? You know, what can you speak to them at this point to say, do you wish you had done it sooner? Are you thrilled with the way it went, and was the timing right now? Like, you know, what would you say to those people?
Well, a lot of questions there, Tammy. A lot of layers. I think when I've asked this, and I got asked quite a bit when I was doing work with high school kids and LGBT advocacy work, and would be able to speak to them in a group setting or an individual setting. And what took you so long? Well, part of what I would say to them is everybody has their own journey. And there's a Yiddish term called beshert, B-A-S-H-E-R-T. And beshert means meant to be. And I used that term when I wrote my excerpt in the Journey Out book, that there's a meant to be in each of our lives. So when I was, when kids, high school kids would come to me and say, I want to be able to tell my parents, what am I going to do? Well, first of all, I would never say to one of those students, you've got to do it, or it's a must. Also, I would have to talk to them and work with counselors that might be working with us. You know, what's their situation in their home? For some kids mm-hmm. to do that, it'd be very threatening. They might lose their place in their home. And one of the groups we worked with in our schools was the number of kids that were homeless because they did come out at home and were being excused from their home would be too light of a term, but they didn't have any place to go. So when people ask me, I just let them know, where's your place in time? Who's the people you can talk to about this? I was blessed in my own process that I was able to not only talk to that person that I knew from first grade that had was able to guide me through some of the process, and a couple of other friends that I had that I became acquainted with that helped me in my journey in those years coming out of the marriage and starting into this phase, this part of my life. I was able to have that. So one thing I always talk to people about when they do bring it up, make sure you have a support system. I'd be happy to be part of that support system. But who you have in your life, whether they're gay, whether they're straight, whether they're related, whether they're not, who is somebody that you can unpack this with? Because day to day, hour to hour, things are going to change and feelings are going to just come in. And that's what I say to people, and to let them know that here I had my journey. I shared my journey with you, but my journey is not yours. Your journey is your own, and they can use my journey as a, for lack of a better word, a model. But there's no cookie cutter here. There is no prescription. There is no, well, that's the way Kevin did it. It's not going to work that way. So I say to people, you can't go into a situation thinking, boy, this is going to go just the way it did for so-and-so or so-and-so. But knowing that it's not going to happen the same way for so-and-so and so, who are the people that are going to help you? I use that word navigate again. Who are the people that are going to help you navigate those feelings that you have? And that's been the position or this what I take when people do come to me and ask about it. So.
I love that. And you know, Kevin, what I love about your story is that even though you weren't living that authentic life, you had a beautiful life. You had a family, you had a successful career, you had two beautiful children that you had the privilege to raise. So it wasn't even like, you know, you were at a standstill or living in this like mess. You went on to have this beautiful life. And this is now a new chapter of this continuation of this beautiful life. And you've tapped into now the authentic part of it, but you still were able to enjoy all of the other things as well. And it's unfortunate that people get hurt, but people get hurt every day. We're all getting hurt. And I think that's where we're going to walk into this next part about grief. But I think that that makes you invincible too, is that you did what you thought was right at the time. Right. What do they say? You do the best you can with what you have in the moment. And you did that.
And I've had a lot of moments. So.
And yes. And you've done that. And you've had so many great experiences and great accomplishments and contributions to the world in this journey that you've taken. And I think that that's amazing. I do. So I mean, I know now you're living your best life, right? As you say, because now it's authentic. But I also think that there were so many other amazing things as well. And I'm just so thrilled to know you and
to
be able to call you friend. I want to talk about grief for a few minutes. Because, well, first of all, your book is called Two Floors Above Grief. So you have seen a lot of grief in your lifetime, whether it's been in your own life or even at the funeral home, with all of the death and all that surrounds that. I can't even imagine. I feel like we're going to have a second episode to talk more about that. But I would say get the book because, and we'll talk, you know, the link to the book will be in the show notes. But I've been reading through the book and it is, the stories are just amazing. And so let's talk about grief. Like, and I feel like, yes, we don't say you're a grief expert, but you are now working on this grief navigator. And I love that. And because I think that grief should be navigated, right? I mean, it is an ongoing journey. And when we're taking a long journey, we need navigation, right? So much so that now it's on our phones, it's in our cars, it's everywhere, right? And so life is that way too. And so is grief. And so let's talk a little bit about grief as you know it. There's so much grief in this journey, as you said, to wonderful, wonderful women were hurt. But then there's your own grief too. The grief of hiding what you knew, the grief of bringing it out and hurting people, the grief of ending relationships. There comes grief with all of those things. So what do you know about grief?
Whoa. Well, yeah, my grief is rooted in my growing up experiences. And the reason I chose the title, though, actually a colleague of mine helped me create the title. From a young age, I didn't know any different than life passages. Even as a young kid, it was even as a baby, a toddler, when my dad was working in the funeral home, he might have me playing on the floor with blocks or something as he was setting up flower displays or playing the organ or moving chairs around, you know. So and then later I would be as a teenager, one of my roles was to open the door and greet people as they came into the funeral home and introduce myself. And so I knew why people were coming and I knew some of the families. I knew sometimes the people who had died, even at a young age of five, when my 16-year-old cousin was killed in an auto accident and her funeral was at our house. So, I mean, those were things that helped, that made me aware of sadness and grief and passages, probably more so than other kids my age, even as a teenager, there are a lot of kids my age who didn't have those experiences or maybe even hadn't ever had knew a grandparent or a sibling or anybody else to die. Some people don't get those first experiences till their 20s or their 30s. I had it as a toddler. So I think that that's something that separates me a little bit from the topic of other people that are working with grief. No, I am not a grief expert. I had the pleasure of meeting some who I would consider experts and reading about some. There are so many, and you and your podcast world know this. I just downloaded something the other day, you know, looking for other podcasters that work on grief. What I came up with was the top 21, according to the ratings, the top 21 podcasts for grief. That means if there's a top 21, there must be at least 21 more or another 50. So there's a lot of people in a podcast format that are helping people work on this concept of grief, and blogs and everything else, tools that people did not have in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, 80s, when grief tended to be buried. And when grief, somebody dies, the funeral director takes care of what needs to be done. The funeral comes, you have your luncheon afterwards, and life goes on. But life just doesn't go on. I saw a graphic. I wish I could pull it up. Our perception of how grief lasts is it peaks at the death and during the funeral, and then it drops down. But the graph showed there's one. The graph was our perception peaking and then dropping, when the reality was that it was level all across this diagram. That grief comes and goes and enters and re-enters, and I know that. Yeah. Having experienced grief and death with my parents, knowing that it's been almost 40 years for my dad, 15 years for my mom. But there's still elements of grief that come in that just grab me by the throat sometimes and say, damn, I wish you were here. Why? What do you do? What can you tell me about this situation? Why can't I talk to you? And that certainly happens not only with them, but friends I have and that have passed, and certainly the older I get, the more it's happening. So I think I put something on Instagram the other day on my Grief Navigator site was just the idea that one of the things we can do to navigate grief, you got to find people to talk to about it. Give the people, and you know, there's the concept of the wait or the Shiva, whoever you want to call it, but that time that and offer your time, offer your listening. Not so much you have to go in and say something. It's just be there, be present. And I think that speaks a lot to the people that are experiencing it. Reach out. And I think as we navigate grief, if we have to feel that it's okay to ask or to talk to people. And sometimes, even though I might be feeling the grief myself personally, sometimes my friends or my family, they don't know what to do either. So not to put it all on the griever, but it's okay for the griever to call somebody, to talk to somebody. It's okay for the people that perceive their friend or their family member is having some trouble to reach out, to talk, even if it's a short conversation, just to let people know that you're there. And that speaks volumes, and that goes whether it's the grief from a death or grief from a divorce or grief from an estrangement, grief from leaving a job, grief from I was a school principal at a school that closed. There was grief there when that building closed up.
Yes. Just, yeah. So grief is the end of something, right? Yeah. And it's not always death, but yeah. Death is such a final ending. But grief comes from any ending, right? Any pause, any ending, even the positive things, like you mentioned early on, like in your retirement, you know, there's still a grief in that, even though like that's a natural progression of a career, right? You would retire. That would also create some form of grief to have to handle. And I love what you're saying is talk to somebody, because you really shouldn't go alone in that. And sometimes grief is loneliness, right? Oh. Because of an ending of something. And so one of the things you want to do is surround yourself with the people who bring you joy, who you can authentically share with.
Yeah. And I think too, what happens is I get wrapped up sometimes in thinking that grief equals end. Yeah, it's an end of that part of a life or that part of a being or that part of an existence. But I think when I get into it a little bit or when I think about it, grief can also be and often is a beginning. We don't know when we're so wrapped up in the grief at the beginning, we don't even think about what's going to come next. But it also, I think of friends that have died or family that has died, and it and being part of that grieving process, it's introduced me to people I wouldn't have met otherwise and developed friendships. I didn't know that when I might have gone to this wake or helped a person in their transition. I didn't know what was going to happen. You just live in the moment when it's going on. But I think a lot of times things happen afterwards that wouldn't have happened if that person hadn't passed or that event hadn't happened in your life. So,
yeah, sometimes endings open the doors for beautiful beginnings for sure. Mm-hmm. And I love that. Well, this has been such a great conversation, Kevin. Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much for your authenticity. You really, really brought it today. And I love how authentic you are, because we're here to help people, to give them hope and inspiration to run their race, to get back up wherever they are. And you really did that. And so I'm so grateful for that. And I want to tell our listeners and remind them to get a copy of this amazing book, Two Floors Above Grief by Kevin O'Connor. It's a memoir of two families in the unique place they called home. And I can't even imagine what it was like growing up in a funeral home, but I can't wait to finish reading the book so that I have a better understanding. And it's been really great so far. And so we have the link to the book in the show notes so you guys can get your copy, and all the links to reach out to Kevin. So no matter what topic we've talked about today that you could use that support around, please reach out to Kevin. Just click the link in the show notes and he will be able to help you navigate whatever journey you're on. And Kevin, tell our listeners one place where they can find you.
One place where they can find me. They can find me at my website, Kevin O'Connor. I'll say O'Connor because it's an O-R. KevinO'ConnorAuthor.com. And that takes them to information about the book, ways to link into the newsletter that I send out once a week, other things that are the newsletter tells them what's going on currently with the book and the travels I'm doing and podcast I've been on. Amy's podcast will be a featured podcast at some point on that newsletter. So that's KevinO'ConnorAuthor.com. That's the primary way that they can get in contact with me.
Perfect. Perfect. So, and also, guys, just click the link in the show notes if you weren't able to write that down. Hey, I hope you're enjoying this episode. And just before we get to the good stuff, right? The good, the bad, and the ugly, I have this great announcement for you. We are starting the Pod Power Hour, which is a virtual event that's going to happen on Wednesdays at noon Eastern. And so if you've ever thought about having a podcast, if you have questions, if you are a podcaster and you want to come and meet other podcasters and learn what's new, what's happening, tips and tricks to be better at this amazing passion of podcasting that you have, we would love for you to join us. We're going to have experts there that are going to be sharing their genius. It's going to be amazing. So, and if you're a host and you want to come meet some amazing people that could be potential guests for you on your show, come on out. What a great way to get exposure. Be sure to check it out on my website at CammieLehman.com, as well as follow me on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn. Whatever is your favorite platform, we will have registration there. You do need to register to attend. And it is on Zoom, so super simple, just 1 hour every other Wednesday. We start on May 4th, so don't miss out. Get registered today. We can't wait to see you there.
You have moved from fighting cancer to discovering how to live beyond it. But what now? With so many emotional side effects still unknown, as a new survivor, you find yourself in a void as you navigate through the isolation, fear, and an uncertain future that can overshadow you and your family for years to come. Instead of focusing on the uncertainty of cancer, consider how strong and determined you are, and think of the strength demonstrated by those who stood beside you through it all. Consider this. You now get to choose who you want to be and what your intentional, fulfilled life can look like. You made it through treatment. We can help you define yourself as a survivor. We're here to help you through this moment, to walk beside you as you shift your mindset from counting the days of life to creating a legacy. For more information, visit www.adventuretherapyfoundation.org or contact us at info@adventurefound.org.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for being here and for being invincible. Just what a joy to be able to have this conversation with you.
Good. And I guess we covered the good, the bad, and the ugly, as I
talk. Well, not yet. We're about to. So we're going to break it down. So that's what I was going to say. You know, we promise our listeners we're going to bring them fierce entrepreneurs. And yeah. we're gonna give them all the expert things, which I think you did so well today, talking about grief and about your coming out and just the support that you are providing for other people on these journeys. But we're not done, because we also promise our listeners.
I didn't mean to steal your thunder. I'm sorry.
You didn't. We also promise our listeners that while we're spotlighting these fierce entrepreneurs, that we also want to pull back the curtain and we want to share the good, the bad, and the ugly, because people look at you and think, oh, he's so lucky, right? He wrote a book. He's living his best life in Florida, yada, yada. The truth is, they want your success, but they don't want to pay the price you had to pay. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to pay the price. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we do this, is not that you haven't been authentic, because you have, but we love to just pull it back and say, like, hey, this is the good, the bad, and the ugly of this journey. Too many times people aren't willing to take that. They give up before. They throw it all in. They give up because it's hard, right? And it's, you know, and nobody hears those stories, but they're there. And so we compare to this success. We never compare to the journey. So are you ready to tell a few stories? Okay. Sure. And you may have talked briefly about some of these. I don't know, but let's get started and we'll see where we go. So, and we have just a few minutes. So tell us a quick story about the good or the greatest part of your journey so far.
The good and the greatest part is
now.
Yeah. And it's my life with Leon, my life with our children and grandchildren. If you had told me, if anybody had told me when I was thinking about coming out or struggling with who I was or authenticity, that this would happen in my life, I would think, well, that must be written in a book. When I look back at how this has all happened, and how I'm at this, it's a gift. It's a gift. And to have this gift in this senior phase of my life, what a way to be living. I don't want to call the exit, but I'm at the last whatever. But to have this part of who I am. And as I look back and think, I didn't know I was going to, if I'd known I was going to be here, the prior years wouldn't have been as rich as they were probably. But there's a song called On My Way to You. I think Streisand sings it, one of the singers, On My Way to You. And part of that is the idea that all kinds of things happen on the way to find the person that you spend your life with. And that's the good part for me. That's the good part.
I love that. That's so great. Okay. Tell us a story about the bad. We're going to save the ugly for last, but tell us a story about the bad part of the journey.
Well, two bad parts. One bad part was just when I would get so depressed at some parts of my life that I would just have to be so alone and so. And one of those times, I actually got to the point where I was parked in a car, and finally said, "This is not good," and I drove myself to the counselor and said, "I said to him." Hey, I've had this idea in my life that It's okay to think about suicide. It's okay to think, how would I do it? And his name was Joe. And I said that to him, and he said, I'm glad you came right in. He says, no, that's not the way it's supposed to be. You don't have to live that way. And then he's the one. So I wasn't that. I didn't know it was a precipice, but it was. And thank goodness for Joe, who said, let's keep talking and let's get you to somebody else that can help you. And that is really what led me on a good part of my journey. And the other bad part that I have experienced in the last 7 or 8 years is this estrangement from one of my children. And it's just something I've felt like I've had little to no control over. And it's grief. It's certainly all the elements that we talk about grief. And but fortunately, there are people and resources available there to help. And I have worked through and continue to work through those resources. But estrangement is another place I never thought I'd be, or that a term that I never thought would be attached to who I am. But it's very strong and it's very pervasive and it's very bad.
Yeah, that's hard. All right. Tell us about an ugly part of your journey.
Well, I guess that's more current too. When I was going over this, the ugly part is just, it's really living in today's atmosphere of divisiveness, whether it's divisiveness in morally or emotionally or politically. You know, I thought I saw and lived that ugly during the Vietnam War when I was a young 20-something and protesting the war and watching kids die and going off to Vietnam. I thought that was an ugly part. And I thought the shootings and the riots that we've seen in so many cities since that time. And then being an educator, boy, the ugliness of school shootings. Wow. That is so ugly, in the atmosphere of locked down schools. I mean, having lived through that as a school teacher and a principal, where we used to be able to keep all the doors open and let the air come in and keep a door open so you could go freely out to the playground. That doesn't happen anymore. And that's an ugly. It's just this everyday presence of hatred. That's extraordinarily ugly, I think. And that's an ugly part for me.
I agree. I remember as you said that, you just took me back to memory lane. Remember when you could just walk out the door of the school and bang the erasers? And it was like the treat when you got picked to be the one to bang the erasers.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, and you could just walk right out the door and do it. And there was, you know, you could be by yourself. And it's just so different now. I'm so happy that I'm not raising children in this time, because it is scary. It is more than I could handle, I'm sure.
Yeah, it is.
I agree. And that is ugly. The world has become very ugly. So, oh my gosh. Well, Kevin, thank you. Thank you for all of this. Thank you for your courage and for being invincible and for being with us and sharing it with us today. I know you've inspired many. You guys, make sure to reach out to Kevin. Click the link in the show notes. Any final words, Kevin, that you have to share with our listeners?
Well, I'm just so high and happy with our conversation today. And we had we ebbed and flowed a little bit here. But to end on a high note, I'm just so elated that we've had this time together. And I look forward to further work with you and other people that we work with in the podcast industry. That's also a part of the good part of life right now, too.
I love it. Oh, my gosh. All right, you guys, you know what we say. I don't know where you are in your life or your business, but if you're face down on the ground right now, get back up. You can do it. I know it's hard. I know you feel like you can't, but we're here today to tell you, you can do it. Just get back up. You can do anything. You are invincible. Thank you for joining us today. If you were inspired or learned something new, please follow the show, submit a rating and review, and share us with your friends. If you would like to chat to see if you can attract your ideal client and monetize your business through podcasting, please book a free call with me at CammieLehman.com. I can't wait to meet you.